Yes. All right. Welcome, ladies, again. Congratulations to the winners.
Thank you.
Just saying, next time I think these should be worth like 10 points each. Just to clarify, if we can work on the rules for the next round of that tomorrow morning, that'd be great. I'll have that. I'll have my purse ready. Not that competitive, girl. So we're going to have a blessed evening tonight. We've had a wonderful summer of women sharing their stories. And this evening, you can hear from our very own Jessica Perry.
Hey, Jess.
Yay! So I get a chance to introduce my friend, who I love, and have
a... Here 5 months later.
5 months later. It might be 10 after I introduce you.
So, 5 months later, you're good.
Right? You know what's so fun about hearing people's testimony? Most people ask when they are getting ready to hear someone speak, is like, gosh, I wonder what drama is in her past that she's going to share about in her story. And so I dug a little bit to kind of come up with more information than what she was willing to publicly share with me on this day. And let me just tell you, life of crime, that girl. Life of crime. And then she got saved when she was about 4 years old, and she repented from all of her evil ways. So we get to be five. Jessica is one of our pastors here at Long Run Up Church, and leads us in worship and helps coordinate all of our media and gives kind of a look and feel to things. So we love her creative spirit. She's got a lot of talent in that area. She was raised by the lovely Miss Karen Mahan here, and her dad, who's our senior pastor at Long Run Up Church as well. So Jess has her BA in Music and Worship Arts from Hope International University. What? We have a lot of people I know in this area. She has expertise in a lot of different fields, and many of you get blessed by all the different things that she does. She is very creative. She works with flowers and photography, I mean. Flowers. Well, you do that. It's on your resume. I'll give you her number for floral arrangements later. She loves to cook. She has even a hashtag you can follow on Instagram, Prairie Culinary Masterpiece hashtag. And you can follow and get involved with her there. Her and her husband have been married for
2.5 years.
2.5 years now.
Yay.
You get to hear a little bit about that story tonight as well. If you enjoyed coming to a Better Story a couple of years ago at Hope, and this year's This Is Me gathering at Hope International, Jessica is part of that leadership team who puts all that together, and we were all blessed because of it. Most of all, we're all blessed just to know her. If you know her personally, you know her as somebody who's vibrant and enthusiastic and loves the Lord, and just oozes from every part of her. So tonight we get to hear her story of encouragement, and I'd like you to welcome right now, Jessica.
Yeah. All right. All right, we're good. I have some friends who wanted to be here and couldn't, so we're live streaming, so I guess I have to look at my big face on the camera. Sorry about that. But I am super excited to be here tonight. Thank you so much, Jen, for asking, and it's really just a privilege to come and share with you a little bit. Have any of you ever gotten a gift that you really, really hated?
That was like the worst gift.
Yeah. Totally regiftable, right? Yeah. So as you may or may not have noticed, I am not a toy. I am, you know, as my Aunt Katie would have put it, I'm not a toy person. I am a full person of girth and other things. So I've always had, you know, always been a big kid. And when I was little, my Grammy, my dad's mom, she would make all of the grandkids sweatshirts every Christmas. And she was known for taking patterns from, like, coloring books. And she would take the pattern from the coloring book and then make a pattern with fabric and sew it on a sweatshirt. And one year, when I was like 7 or 8, Grammy decided that I needed a bright peach sweatshirt with a giant ice cream sundae on the front. Yes, let's give the chunky kid the bright peach sweatshirt. And so that's one of those, take the picture, send it to Grammy, burn the gift. It's never going to get worn ever. But, you know, it's sometimes we all get gifts that we don't really like, we're not particularly fond of. We would perhaps re-gift if we could. And to be honest, my life really has not turned out anything like I thought it was going to. Here's the story tonight of the gifts that God has given me that I didn't particularly want or ask for. And how being willing to use those gifts to lead kind of a plan B life has made all the difference. As Jen alluded, My story is not super dramatic. There is no, despite for digging, deep hidden sin, no dramatic interventions, no great cosmic awakenings. I am very boring. I am. But God is very good. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. I grew up the only child in a very musical family. I don't know if you've ever seen my mom and dad sing or play the piano or anything, but music was kind of our big thing. From the time I was tiny, I was singing. Before I could even speak words, I was singing in the backseat of the car and baby gibberish. And then there's a story told. My dad was a worship pastor. When I was a kid, he was a worship pastor here when I was little. But before that, when I was about two, he would direct a choir at River Linda Friends Church. And there's a story that I've been told several times of me standing on the front pew, waving my hands in the air because dad was directing the choir. So music's always been something really, really important to me. I love musicals. I love opera. There's a very famous snake story involving my deep desire to be Christine Daae from Phantom of the Opera. It's a very long story, so I won't tell it here, but later we can maybe talk about the snake story. I started piano lessons at the age of 5, and I started voice lessons at the age of 12. I did a ton of singing in high school. I was at church and school plays. I'm sure there are photos floating around of when I did church plays here as a kid. Uh-huh. I'm sure Julie has them. I've had a few pop ups since I've been back, and let me just say, there was a lot of neon. It was like eight. So I started piano at the age of 5, but here's my deep dark secret. I hated piano. I hated it. I hated taking lessons. I hated practicing. I was like, Mom, you hate me. Why are you making me take me out of the time? This is the worst. And she's like, you're going to practice. You're going to learn to play the piano. But I hated it. I didn't want to do it. And I swore up and down. The one thing that I was never, ever going to do, because I hated it so much, was play the piano in church. I really hated it. What I hated the most was, everybody always wanted me to play the piano. No one wanted me to, like, really sing. I was known more as a piano player because that's kind of a more rare skill. Singers can kind of be a dime a dozen, but piano players are harder to find, and that really bothered me. And so that kind of bothered me all throughout high school. And then when I was trying to decide where I wanted to go to college, it was going to be PCC, as Jen alluded. I wanted to go to Hope. Not because they had anything there that really drew me program-wise, but because my mom and dad met there. And in this great romantic sense, as only a diva 17-year-old can have, I wanted to go to PCC because it was very romantic. It was my family destiny. It worked out. They did have two programs that I was interested in. I wanted to either be a third grade teacher or I wanted to go into theater. And I could take a program with Cal State and be an English major with a theater emphasis. But I got to PCC. I was actively involved in the music department. I took voice lessons and piano lessons for like 2 semesters just because I was, you know, trying to be good. And I even sang in an ensemble. We traveled from church to church. And we would go and sing. It was 6 girls. It's called Sanctified. It was super fun. We would just go around and sing. And I even had, this was my spiel, because I was undeclared. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I would come up and say, hi. My name is Jessica Mayhem, and I am a freshman from River Linda, California, majoring in underwater basket weaving. So that was my little spiel. Sometimes I would switch it up and say I was majoring in indecision. But I really genuinely thought, I'm going to marry a pastor. Like, that was my plan. Not plan so much as more just like that's how life was going to be, because all the pastor's wives I ever knew played the piano and taught school. That's what I wanted to do, right? But in November of my freshman year, my uncle Jeff, my dad's brother, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And he had a business in Las Vegas where he was maintaining natural gas compressors. And my dad and a friend from the church were... My dad and a friend from the church that we were attending at the time were actually traveling back and forth every week from Southern California to Vegas to keep the business afloat and to take care of my uncle and my aunt. And so that kind of was going on my freshman year. This was happening my freshman year of college. And in June, my uncle passed away. And that's an amazing story all of its own of God's incredible faithfulness and just how good God is. But as a result of that, we planned for both of our families. So mom and dad and I, and then our friend Bill and his wife and their kids, we were all going to move to Las Vegas and continue this family business. And then in December of that year, after I had gone and gotten my associate's degree to try to make it easier to transfer, all this kind of stuff, the contract fell through. It didn't get renewed. And so we kind of went, okay, we're not moving. We're not going anywhere. And I was really faced with this idea, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm in my second year of college. I still haven't declared a major yet. I got to figure this out because Hope is not an inexpensive school, so I need to know quickly what I'm going to do so I don't, you know, mess myself up forever. And I remember in January of 2001, we had been at church at a church potluck, and after church, I was standing kind of, you know those parking stanchions below where you don't go any further, you'll run into a wall? Mm-hmm. I was standing with my foot on the handicap lawn, and I was chatting with my dad after this potluck, and just trying to talk about what I wanted to do, and I remember I had my foot, and I was kind of like playing with this, and all of a sudden, I heard a voice in my head say, "Why are you fighting me?" And I went, and I realized that the Lord was speaking to me, and I went, "Why am I fighting you?" And I realized that the thing that I had been literally born to do, that I had done since the time I was a tiny child, was music. And I had refused over and over and over again to use it for His glory. I mean, I'd done Sanctified, but that was because I could be on stage. That was cool. And when God says to you, "Why are you fighting me?" there's really not a good response. Nothing seems to make sense at that point. You're kind of like, no, that's not going to fly anymore. And so I went back to college, and that next semester, I declared as a worship arts major at Hope. And the program had just changed. It went from being a music ministry major to a worship arts major, and it was kind of like the timing was really great. And I finished up my degree as a worship arts major, learning how to lead worship, how to lead a band, all the other tech stuff that goes along with it. And on July 1st, 2004, I started in my first ministry. So I actually just celebrated 14 years last Sunday. You know, it's amazing. God took the thing that I swore I would never do, and He used it to birth really the greatest passion of my life, which is leading and equipping other people to grow and to walk in their faith with the Lord. He uses music to do it. He's really birthed in me the ability to use a thing that not only am I decently okay at doing, but also enjoy and love to do, to serve others and to serve His kingdom. And so that's kind of the first Plan B experience in my life. And I remember I got my diploma. I had been actually at a youth conference in Azusa, and I left early to come and walk across the stage to get my diploma, and I shook the president's hand, and then I walked across the stage, and I took my picture, and then I flipped my tassel, and I stepped off the stage, and I went, "I'm still single." Literally, that was the thought. I went, "I'm single. I'm very single." I hadn't gone to PCC to get my MRS degree. I went for my BA. But I kind of always thought I'd pick it up along the way, double major. And not only had I not gotten my MRS, because let's be real, Hope had 4-1, 4 girls for every guy. The pickings were slim. Well, for me, it was very robust for the men's. But there just wasn't an opportunity. I think I went on maybe 2 dates in college. It was not great. And I've never really been someone who had terribly much luck with the opposite gender. I remember in high school, there was this guy named John Crandall who called me up one night, and he goes, "So I'm thinking about asking you to prom, but I'm thinking about asking this other girl too. I'm going to call you back and let you know."
Oh my God.
20 minutes later, Home Slice calls me back and is like, "Just kidding, I'm going to ask the other girl." And I was like, I hung up the phone, and I was like, "I don't even like you, but this is the worst thing ever." And it's like a hot mess. My friends were very unhappy. And in college, I had this friend that I had a really solid crush on for a long period of time. He's a really good friend. He was in the music department. And I got my roommate, my best friend, I was like, "Hey, do me a favor. Be my wingman and go up and talk to him and be like, 'What about Jess?'" And so my best friend, like the trooper that she was, she goes up and she's like, "So, what about Jess?" And he's really nice. He goes, "Well, you know, I can see myself married to her or someone like her, but I'm just not attracted to her." And I was like, dead, you know. That's a verbatim quote, by the way. It's only been 10 years. It's not like it stuck with me or anything. Yeah, not at all. And he goes, it's funny. I'm missing a page real quick. Oh, there we go. I actually started on eHarmony online dating when I was 21 years old. eHarmony was brand new. But the pickings were so slim at the college that it was like, any port and a storm, we will do that. And let me tell you, I've got some stories. There are some weird dudes out there. but as you might be picking up, my singleness, especially when I graduated college, my singleness was a very painful thing. It might have been the single greatest source of pain in my life because it touched on all the areas of insecurity and the things that I didn't like about myself or that people had alluded to being not enough or too much of. It hurts. You know, all my friends at this point, they're off getting married and they're starting families and having babies. And here I am, just like, what's up? You know, I'm putting my head down. I'm doing the best that I can to honor God. But really, that singleness just amplified everything I hated about myself. And I cried, basically, if you knew how to say the right words, for 7 years straight. There was always something right there that was going. My 25th birthday in particular, my poor mom remembers, that one was rough. The thing I wanted most in the world was the thing that God refused to give me. And I didn't really understand. You know, wasn't I doing all the things that God wanted me to do? I was serving Him. I was in ministry. I had devoted my life to the church. Why on earth would He allow this? By this point, you know, as I'm in my late 20s, I was at a new church, full-time ministry now, and I'm counseling, running women's ministries, I'm counseling women in difficult marriages, and I am teaching relationship classes, ironically. And I was single with no prospects, none whatsoever. The best part, or should I say the worst part, was getting all these kind of platitudes like, well, you know, you just need to fall in love with Jesus. And when you fall in love with Jesus, the right one will come up. I was like, I love Jesus. This is not an issue. And like, why are you so single? I don't understand. I don't understand either. I'm a catch. Like, this is good. But it was just well-meaning platitudes from people who just really didn't know how to engage in that. And here's the thing. You know, people are always like, it's going to happen. Someday you're going to get married. It's going to be a thing. And I very quickly realized that God does not promise us that He is going to make all of our wildest hopes and dreams come true. He doesn't promise us a spouse, kids, a great car, a good DMV photo, none of it. And anyone who tells you that God will definitely bring you a husband or He will definitely bring you X or Y or Z definitely has nothing really to support that position. It's pretty much an empty platitude. What isn't an empty platitude, though, is this verse. 2 Corinthians 1:3 says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort." That was a verse that really became very powerful for me. At an evening when I was actually here, I was here on a Thursday night for a worship service at the church many, many years ago, long before I was ever even remotely thought to come on staff. And there was a song that the team at the time was doing, and it had been a bad week, bad day, bad lifetime, it felt like. And it just pulled out and spoke to me. And I looked the verse up when I got home. And that word comfort, that's the one that stood out to me. Because I was a strong, capable woman who didn't need no man. She wanted one, but she didn't need no man. And I didn't really ever need God's comfort, right? Because I was strong. I was capable. I was a pastor. I could do all these things. And I looked up that word comfort. And it's actually, the Greek word is paraklesis. And if that sounds familiar, it's because the word parakleto, or paraklete, is the word for Holy Spirit in the New Testament. And what it means is the one who comes alongside. So when that scripture is saying that He is the God of all comfort, what it's saying is that He is the God that comes right alongside you in every circumstance and in every situation. And He is right there and He is present. That was truly the greatest blessing in that season of my life. Because in the midst of what was deep, soul deep pain, because it got to the very core of who I thought I was and all of my fears and insecurities and things that I hated, I knew God in a very intimate way. because he heard me cry in my car a lot. He heard me yell a lot. He heard me just be so frustrated and in such pain all the time. But he was always right there and always present. And so that was, I think, the greatest blessing in that season. On December 8th, 2012, I turned 30. And I said, okay, God, well, I guess that dream is done. I packaged it up, and I kind of put it aside. And I said, well, I'm 30. I work in a church where there's no guys, and that's my only job. And so, well, I guess that means that you're done with that dream for me, said the son. Every year we had a tradition in our family that we would go up the week between Christmas and New Year's to Lake Arrowhead to a timeshare that my mom and dad got for us, steal off of eBay, let me tell you. And we would go up and just kind of refresh and retool because it was a busy season in ministry, and we would use that week to kind of decompress but also plan for the next year. And on December 31st, which is New Year's Eve, we had the TV on and we're doing stuff. And I am not kidding you when I say eHarmonyChemistry.com, Match.com, JDate.com, Christian Mingle, Christian Cafe, FarmersOnly.com. They use their entire annual budget in one day. It didn't matter what channel we turned on. Every other commercial was for one of these dating services. And I was like, Lord, you need to stop this. I'm done. I already said no. I'm like, you said no. I'm 30. That's it. We're having a close-up shop. This is done. And finally, at like, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night, I'm like, fine. This is the last time I'm doing this. If this doesn't work, I'm deleting my accounts. We're not doing this ever again. The end. Full stop. And I reactivated my eHarmony account, closed my laptop, and I went, Happy New Year, and went to bed. And the next morning at 8:45, I pulled up my cell phone with my email, and it had a match from a guy named John. And at 1:45 that afternoon, I got a, John would like to chat with you, email. And I went, okay. And we went on our first date on January 15th, 2013, I guess. And let me tell you about John. He's so cute. He's very, very smart. He's a lawyer. Score. He's a lawyer. He's funny. He's very witty. He's sharp. He's quick. He's a godly man, a man of prayer, who loves the Lord, raised in a family who loves Jesus, has a tradition of ministry and a history of being very involved in church. He's a Hurricane Katrina survivor. He was there on vacation, and the airlines just kind of ditched him, and he walked through Hurricane Katrina, and the stories are nuts that he tells of being stuck in just outside the French Quarter for a week with no power, no super, no nothing. He has super cute blue eyes. He's got a dimple that is adorable, and I love it. And when he knows he's being cute, he does this thing where he, like, turns on the smolder, like the guy from Tangled. You're seeing the Tangled in your kid movie where he's like smolder and he like kind of stares you down. I call it his GQ move, but that's definitely super, super cute. And as you might guess, that didn't end after just a week or two. 2 years later, we were engaged. We were supposed to have been engaged in January. We had talked after Christmas, like maybe it's time to go shopping for a ring. And so in January, we were going to go. I wasn't supposed to know when it was, but I told him. And, but we had to cancel. He'd gotten sick. He'd gotten real bad cold. One of the other things that's really extraordinary about John is that when he was 17 years old, he was diagnosed with a very rare autoimmune disorder called Wegener's granulomatosis, which is a mouthful. Basically, what it means is that your body, as with any autoimmune disorder, sees healthy tissue in your body and says, invader, intruder, bad, and it builds these granulomas around the source of what it perceives to be a threat. And in Wegener's, it can affect any system in your body, particularly, though, it seems to, like, your sinuses, lungs, and kidneys. And when he was 17, he was diagnosed with this, and if they hadn't caught it when they did, he would not be here. It always, untreated, will always result in death. And so he got sick with what we thought was a pretty bad case of bronchitis in January. We now realize that that was probably the first incident of a flare. Whether it will go into remission, it will come out of remission, that sort of thing, kind of like other autoimmune disorders can go in and out of remission. That summer, he got very sick. We got engaged in February. It was lovely. On the cliffs of La Jolla, it was great. The Bubba's Barbecue flyover with the banner that said Bubba's Barbecue, it was very romantic. He didn't plan it. It was just a bonus. We were planning our wedding. We had a date set for October. And he got sick. He got double pneumonia. He was actually hospitalized over Labor Day weekend. And I left his hospital room 2 weeks later to go to my bachelorette party. And it was a really stressful time. He began treatment, which used to be, back in the day, the treatment for this autoimmune disorder. Before the 70s, there was no treatment. In the 70s, they discovered that chemotherapy would fix it. And so until 2011, the only treatment was chemotherapy, Cytoxan. And he took oral chemotherapy by mouth for off and on for many, many years. Thankfully, in 2011, the FDA approved a new treatment called Rituxan, which is a lot more manageable. Instead of being a nuclear bomb in your body, it's like a little tiny bomb, like a homing bomb. He began his first treatment of that on October 13th. It was a Tuesday. We got married on October 17th. It was a Saturday. And he was a very sick guy. He was really sick on our wedding day. And if you look at our photos, you can tell he's on all kinds of medications, and he just doesn't look like himself in our photos. We had canceled our honeymoon because we knew he was in treatment, so he owes me a trip to the Caribbean. The day before our wedding, we're getting ready for the rehearsal. He had went to the ER with chest pains. He didn't know it was a side effect of the treatment. It was a difficult couple of days. This was definitely not how I had dreamed of getting married, right? It's your wedding. It's the thing that I've dreamed about forever, and lo and behold, I finally get it. And the guy that I'm passionately in love with, madly in love with, who is this amazing man of God, is sick, very, very sick. I wasn't quite angry at God, but I'll be honest that I was struggling. It was hard. I loved him. I loved my husband so much. But really, despite my best efforts, I was, as much as I had tried, I was still unprepared for what it was like to have a sick husband. The only time we've really ever argued in our relationship, and it's been since we've been married, is over my unmet expectations in our marriage. I felt, especially in those early days, that I really carried the full weight of the marriage because I was going to the grocery store, I was paying bills, I was cooking, I was cleaning, I was doing all these things, I was still working a full-time job. And I was doing all of the maintenance of our marriage, but he was sick, and he was still going to work. He didn't miss a day of work unless it was to go get a treatment. So I had a sick husband who was still being awesome, and I was just being basically a turd, because I was so hurt. I was hurt because I was doing all these wonderful sacrificial things, and how dare he not appreciate or acknowledge or reward my deep sacrifice. I'm not going to mention that I'm just doing the things that I was supposed to be doing, not only as a wife, but as a Christian. But I did. I felt unseen and unloved and uncherished. And these were emotions that I had struggled with when I was single. You know, they brought back up all those single emotions again. You know, in different roles, I've had these same things. As an always responsible daughter, as a student, as a pastor, as a child of God, and now as a wife. So not only did I not take the advice that I always handed out like candy to all the ladies who would come to my office, right, about honoring your husband in the midst of a fight, honoring God more importantly in the midst of a fight, but I couldn't even muster up enough empathy for my still sick husband. I was so wrapped up in my own disappointment, pain, and frustration that nothing was going my way. On Valentine's Day, we had been married just about 4 months, and my brother-in-law and sister-in-law had gotten engaged just a few months after we did, and their wedding was in March of that next year. And so we were going to go to Vegas for my sister-in-law's bachelorette party. And because it was Valentine's Day weekend, John was going to come with me because it's our first Valentine's Day married. I'm not going out of town, right? And I did the bachelorette things, and then I came back, and we had this, we got in a nice hotel and done all these things. But we had a big fight, as a lot of Valentine's Day stories often end up in, because I had ideas about the romance of Valentine's Day that was supposed to be, and my unmet expectations that I had never communicated in any way, shape, or form, he should just know, went unfulfilled, right? And so when we got home, I was crabby, and I didn't talk to him for 2 days. Not my crabbiest moment. But you know what? He was so gracious and so generous. And God used that one big blow-up fight in our marriage to show us, first off, we weren't as good of communicators as we thought we were. And second, it really gave us the ability to open up to one another and be honest about the things that were bothering us. For the first time ever, I opened up to John about all of the hurts and insecurities that I had had as a teenager, as a college kid, all throughout my young adult life. He opened up about feelings of insecurity because he was afraid of missing out on things because he was sick, and all of the emotions that that dragged up in him. And it was ultimately a really great moment in our marriage. 6 months in, we decided, you know, he was starting to get a little bit better. He wasn't in remission yet, but he was getting better. Let's start thinking about building our family because, you know, I was 33 by this point. I'm not getting any younger. There was some things that needed to happen before I got, like, dusty and stuff. They tell you by 35 that, you know, you're a high-risk pregnancy. And I was like, I'm 33. The clock is ticking, right? But it became apparent very quickly that we were going to have problems conceiving. John did go into remission finally in February of last year, 2017. And after a year of trying, so by November of last year, we finally, you know, they tell you you have to wait a year, right, before you go. And so we waited a year. We saw a fertility specialist, and the specialist that we saw, a series of them, confirmed that years of chemotherapy and other treatments, which had saved John, had really robbed us and stolen our ability to have a child that was genetically ours. Even if we went through surgeries and procedures, the odds were just not very good. And I got to tell you, that was hard. The deepest longing of my heart has always been to be a wife and a mom. By eighth grade, I was a teacher's aide at school and at church. In high school, I directed children's choirs. I ran a children's ministry in college. I teach piano to small humans. I've taught for 14 years. I love kids. I love kids. It's been an emotionally draining journey for John and I, both of us. John struggles with feelings of inadequacy. Well, I struggle with feeling that God just wants to use me for what I can do for him, but doesn't want to help me. And over the past 2.5 years, in the midst of really this fertility journey, there have still been other health issues. John has a completely collapsed left lung, upper left lung, as a result of granulomas. He's not usable able to use that. He's lost his sense of smell and taste as a result of chronic inflammation. And then we had to cancel our makeup honeymoon cruise to Hawaii, of all places, because we needed the money to pursue adoption. So now he owes me a trip to Hawaii, too, and the Caribbean. We bought and remodeled a house. I changed jobs. We came here. You know, the only church that we had known as a couple together, we left, and God called us here, which is, you know, a stress on a relationship because it's like new things. You know, we've been in our house for 6 months. There have been plenty of times when we've just hit the wall of emotion and have to stop and just take a breath. Mother's Day, Father's Day, both very difficult days, as I know that they are for a lot of people. And so I'm very mindful of saying, hey, no, we need to honor that in relationships and in families. But here's the thing, in the midst of our pain, John and I are both incredibly grateful for a few things. We have God who hears and who sees us. And it's been abundantly apparent, more times than I can even tell you. We have amazing family and friends who hold us up in prayer. We have seen God move in totally unexpected ways. Let me tell you, this story is not the one that we wrote for ourselves, but it's the one that God is writing. I am so grateful that John is a man of prayer. He lifts me up. He prays for me. He prays for us. He's been able to do so time and time again when I have not been able to pray. Our marriage is really strong. We are Team Perry. It is God and John and me. And we are against the world. We're taking on all odds, right? are very strong because we are partners and we are not opposition to one another. We've chosen never to blame each other for what has happened, but instead recognize that no one knows the pain the other one is going through like the other one. And so we go to each other with God. As before we got married, we were sitting at a church. We were at church with John's family on a Saturday night at CCV, where his family has attended for a billion years. And the preacher there was talking about the story of the prodigal son. And he said something in all my years of reading that story that I never recognized before. He said, you know, the two sons and the prodigal son, they're actually guilty of the same sin. And I'm like, what? Because I always identified with that older son, right? I did everything right. And, you know, the Lord, the father in the story honors the younger son for his shenanigans. And the older son's like, well, you didn't even give me a goat. Like, what's the deal? And reality is that both sons were really not invested in having a relationship with God. They just wanted what God would give them. They wanted what the father could provide for them, not just having a relationship with him. And so that kind of went, oh, I don't like that feeling. That's a gut punch when I heard that. And I thought, do I love God because of what he will do for me or because he's God? And I had to really wrestle with those questions. The truth of the matter is that sometimes I think God is obligated to do what I want him to do because I'm a good girl who followed all the rules. John and I were pure before the Lord before we got married. We came to our marriage having saved ourselves for each other, our marriage. We honored God with all the things that we did, and still, it didn't work out the way that we thought it was going to. So, yeah, sometimes I think God is required to do what I want him to because I got it all right, but that's not how this works. That's not how any of this works, right? God is my sovereign. He gets to do what he wants to do. And he gets to allow what he wants to allow because he's the ultimate power and authority in my life. So, like, Queen Elizabeth is the sovereign of the United Kingdom because she was born in the right family, right? God is the sovereign over all because he's the only holy creator of heaven and earth. 1 Timothy 6:15 through 16 says, God will bring this about in his own time. He is the blessed and only sovereign, the King of kings and the Lord of lords. The only one who has immortality, dwelling in unapproachable light. No one has seen or can see him. To him be honor and eternal life. Amen. I don't know about you, but I love VeggieTales, not so secretly. Not this new mess. The new stuff is weird, but like the OG VeggieTales from like back in the late 90s where the animation's real sketch. And you know, they was at the end of it, I don't know if you're familiar, they do this thing where they kind of wrap up the whole lesson for the day, and they like, and so what we have learned applies to our lives today. God has a lot to say. So that's this part of my talk. So here's what I have learned today. Psalm 18:6. But in my distress, I cried out to the Lord. Yes, I prayed to my God for help. He heard me from his sanctuary. My cry to him reached his ears. Cry out to Jesus. That's what I've learned. Bring him your honest emotion. If it's pain, if it's sorrow, if it's joy, if it's thankfulness, if it's fear, if it's frustration, if it's anger, whatever it is, it's not hidden from God, so be honest. Come to him, bring it to him. Lay it all out there for him to see. In the book of Job, at the very end, when God is responding to Job, he actually commends Job for coming to him with his honest emotion. Even while he's telling Job in kind of semi-confronting but semi-comforting, hey, do you really know where storehouses of snow are stored? Like, he's like, trust me, I'm God, but good on you for bringing me your pain and your real talk. This is what I want. I once heard it said that any circumstance that forces us to fall at the feet of Jesus is ultimately a good thing. And you know what? I would agree with that. Let God be your comfort and your peace. Immediate presence. He will get you through the pain. Doesn't mean there won't be any pain, but he'll make it happen. He'll get you through. Psalm 62:5 is a verse that I've carried with me from the time I was in high school, and it says, let all that I am wait quietly before the Lord. My hope is in him. This tells me to be patient. Oh, I hate that one. Be patient in the plan B story that God is writing. Let him write it and trust that he can and will use your story for good. It's also a good reminder that I need to shut up and just abide sometimes in the Lord. And then the next chapter reads, Psalm 63, O God, you are my God. I earnestly seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My whole body longs for you in this parched and weary land where there is no water. I have seen you in your sanctuary, and I have gazed upon your power and your glory. Your unfailing love is better than life itself. How I praise you. I will praise you as long as I live, lifting up my hands to you in prayer. You satisfy me more than the richest feast. I will praise you with songs of joy. I lie awake thinking of you, meditating on you through the night. Because you are my helper, I will sing for joy in the shadow of your wings. I cling to you. Your strong right hand holds me securely. The psalmist said it best. There is nothing better than Jesus. I got to be honest. I don't know how people who don't walk with the Lord handle life on life's terms. Because I have a hard time dealing with it. And I have God right beside me. And people say, oh, Christianity is a crutch. I'm like, I'll take it. If it is a crutch, I'll take it. I don't think it is. I think it's God's gracious generosity in providing for us. But even when it hurts because I don't understand what God is doing, and let's be honest, it hurts a lot because I don't understand God at all, I would rather walk through this life hand in hand with Jesus than try to do it on my own. Because on my own, man, that's, ooh, I'm not doing that. When I was thinking through how I wanted to kind of end tonight, I was talking to God. I was like, God, I've got a killer idea. This is how this should end. You're going to let me get pregnant. And then I'm going to tell all the ladies, I got pregnant, and we're going to be all super excited. I am not pregnant. I am definitely not pregnant. But 2 weeks ago, John and I accepted a match from Nightlife Christian Adoptions for adopting 8 embryos. There's a thing called snowflake adoption, where couples that go through IVF and fertility treatments, they have remaining embryos left over after they've completed their families, and they just kind of sit on ice until the family decides what they're going to do with them. And so we've been matched with a couple who had infertility due to lupus, and their story is very sad. And our hearts broke when we heard about their story. It's a husband and wife in Seattle. The wife had lupus, and because of a series of circumstances, they ended up having to get an egg donor. The wife was Japanese. They got an egg donor from Hokkaido, Japan. And so a woman from Hokkaido, Japan is combining with a man from Seattle, Washington. And if God allows, by the end of the year, hopefully we will have a transfer. And the babies from that will be born to John and Jess Perry in Brea, California. You know, and I'll be able to carry the kids to term, God willing. You know, and the truth of the matter is there's no guarantees. There are still plenty more chapters to the Plan B story that God is writing for John and I, for me. I know that there are probably a lot of plot twists yet to come. There are no guarantees that John and I will have a child. These are untested embryos. We don't know if they'll even produce children at all. Maybe God will do a miracle and he will allow us to have a genetic child that's ours. Maybe he won't. C.S. Lewis, who's amazing, once wrote, he who has God and everything else has no more than he who has God alone. And I would totally agree with that. I could have God plus a saucy, cute husband and a home that I love and a church family that I love and as many kids as I could fit into my extended minivan with the high top. And I would have no more than if I simply had a walk with the Lord. And I am overwhelmingly grateful for the fact that God is still writing our story. It's not wrapped up in a tidy, neat bow. And that's okay. I can still have joy in the fact that God is present and God is moving. And I can see him moving, even if it doesn't feel like he's moving. Because he's slow. But as his word said, he's not slow as I would understand. It might be slow as I understand slow, but he's not slow for God. He's right on time, always for God. And so, if you get anything from this, it's that we choose to walk with the Lord because he's good. We honor him in our lives, not because he owes us anything, but because he's God and he's good. And Jesus is better. Would you pray with me? Father, you are so good. And I am so grateful that in every single season that we have encountered thus far, you have been overwhelmingly present and faithful. And I can look back over very important moments in my life, and I can see where you have been there, where you are the Ebenezer stone, that marker that points me back to you. And if I ever forget that you are faithful, all I have to do is look back and see where you have been faithful time and time and time again. So, Lord, I know that my story is not finished. I know that the stories for every single woman in this room, they're not finished either. And I also know that you will take this pain that we all go through for whatever it is that we find ourselves in, and you will use it for your glory. And while we're waiting for it to be redeemed and for it to be restored, in the meantime, you will be present, you will comfort us, and you will love us with that unfailing love that is better than life. We thank you so much, Jesus, for who you are and what you do. In the name of the one who is and was and is to come, we pray. Amen.